call the Civil Law Committee to order. First, Representative Druskowski moves the approval of the 1:31:11 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Members, just quick housekeeping. Wednesday, we've got the State of the State addressed by Governor Dayton. Tomorrow night, and I tried to let Representative Lesh and the DFL side know as soon as we had it scheduled, but we do have a hearing tomorrow evening scheduled for some other bills in front of the committee dealing with the joint physical custody bill. And Representative Scott, that's carrying that. I just want to remind people of that. We won't have committee Wednesday because of the State of the State. And so 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. With that, we've got two bills up today. And we've told the sides to, we're gonna try to keep it to 25 minutes per side. You don't have to use your whole time. And that should include questions. If there's a lot of questions beyond 25 minutes, I'm going to ask that we come back at the end of both presentations to finish any questions, if there is. But hopefully we can get it covered. So we'll get started with Representative Anderson. Diane. And so, Representative Anderson, if you want to come and get started, we're going to hold your side to 25 minutes or less. Feel free to donate some of your minutes, but we do want to give adequate hearing and insight into this bill. So Representative Wardlow will move House File 292 to pass and be re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. I understand, Representative Anderson, there's also an author's amendment that Representative Wardlow would offer as well. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wardlow will move. The amendment should be in your packet, members.
Mr. Chair, so moved. And I also move the author's amendment.
We're just looking for the number.
It's House File 292.
Okay. The amendment we're referring to is the A11 amendment to get it in the shape the author of the bill would like to have it in. So any discussion on Representative Wardlow, who moved the A11 amendment? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion passes. It's in the shape the author would like to present it. Representative Anderson, your time will begin, and please tell us about your bill, and then have your testifiers ready to go as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. Thank you for having me here today. And just wanted to tell you my bill is about parenting plans. And parenting plans are not a new concept, and they have been around for quite a while. There was a task force that was conducted by the federal government. It was called the U.S. Commission on Child and Family Welfare, and they submitted a report called Parenting Our Children in the Best Interest of the Nation, and this was dated back in September of 1996. And they had on their recommendation number 7 in this report that courts should require separating, divorcing, and unmarried parents living apart to attempt to develop parenting plans that set forth parental decision-making, parenting time, and residential arrangements for their children. And so one of the statements in this report says that the commission believes that a parenting plan is the best blueprint for parents' future ties to their children, because it reflects the personal choices of the two people in charge of raising their children. So if anybody wants to see this report, I do have it. And also, there was some legislation that was done, and Andy Dawkins is going to go through some of our past history here for the state of Minnesota. But there was a 2-year Minnesota Supreme Court task force that the state of Minnesota conducted, and it was the final report was dated January 14th, year 2000. And then also what came out of that parenting plan task force is we did actually pass some parenting plan legislation, the legislation that's in current law today, and that was passed back in the 2000 legislative session. And so right now what we have in the state of Minnesota is voluntary parenting plans. And so what this bill does is takes it from going to voluntary parenting plans to mandatory parenting plans. We've been finding that parenting plans are being more well accepted by the courts, and people have understood them a lot more. They've been around for 10 years now, but they seem to be underutilized. So we would like to go to a mandatory parenting plan. One of the changes in the amendment that you have there, we added subdivision 2 and item C, and since we're not having voluntary parenting plans anymore, we are deleting that language. Then in subdivision 3 is where the court shall adopt a parenting plan proposed by both parties instead of the voluntary, what we had before. And we still have the current law so that if the parties don't agree to a parenting plan, the court shall issue a parenting order unless the court makes detailed findings that use of a parenting order is not feasible. And we still have the protections for if there is domestic abuse, we don't order those people into having a parenting plan as well. And then subdivision 4 just basically clarifies that language a little bit more, makes it clearer, and makes it more concise. And I'm going to have Andy Dawkins explain this part a little bit more, too, to people. When we originally did the original parenting plan legislation, the Child Support Department had concerns about making sure that we could enforce these parenting plans in other states that don't have the don't have parenting plans. And so that's the reasoning behind subdivision 4. So really the goal of a parenting plan is to encourage the involvement of both parents in the child's life. So instead of the court spending time trying to determine who is the better parent and how you're going to parent the child, what we're going to look at is how both parents are going to parent the child in the future. So we really want to have the parents be working things out instead of going through a really long and expensive litigation process. So we really believe that parenting plans reduce litigation for parties, and we want to be able to have the parties working together for the benefit of the children. So studies have shown that children really benefit from the involvement of both parents. So just some basic concepts so you can understand what a parenting plan is a little bit more. A parenting plan is a term used to refer to a detailed divorce decree that two people with children can use as part of their divorce settlement. A parenting plan is a written description of each of the parents' responsibilities regarding parental decision-making, parenting time, and residential arrangements. A parenting plan is more specific than a court order. It is developed by parents in consultation with each other and is intended to minimize ambiguity. The intention of the parenting plan is to shift the focus from parenting rights to parenting responsibilities. And a parenting plan is the best way to reflect both parents' personal choices for future parenting responsibilities of their children. And now I'd like to have my testifiers, or do you want to have questions?
Yep, no, let's go to the testifiers, I think would be the most.
Mr. Chairman, Andy Dawkins.
Welcome, Mr. Dawkins, former member of the Civil Law Committee, probably, huh?
That's right. I actually was the chair for a short period.
Chair for a period of time. So, Representative Dawkins, former representative, we welcome you back to the committee in your new hat, although you were counselor back then as well. So.
I was a lawyer before, I was a legislator, and I am a lawyer again now.
That's so, welcome. As you know, identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Andy Dawkins, a lawyer, a family law practitioner, also a part-time child support magistrate in Hennepin County. And I want to start by saying that I miss being here. It's nice to be back. The give and take that goes on here and the trying to do good things for people is really great stuff, and I miss it. I am not here today in any official capacity representing any organization or association. I'm just here based on my experience with doing family law on a daily basis as a lawyer and being a child support magistrate. The veteran legislators here should be complimented on the legislation that's been passed in the last 10, 15 years dealing with families. I think that although their concerns were raised during the committee process on past legislation like the parenting plans law, the income shares model for doing child support, allowing moves out of the state of Minnesota with children based on the best interest of the children, all those changes have been pretty much universally received in the lawyering and the family law litigant community as good changes. So those were good things that the veteran legislators did in the past. And I think that the issues that we're talking about today and the issues that were involved in those laws that I just described were always nonpartisan issues. There were Democrats and Republicans that were for and some against, but mostly for. And they weren't gender-based issues either. I had my as my chief Senate author when I did the parenting plans law was Republican Senator Sheila Cascaden. And I think even though I didn't check in with Representative Houseman Alice before I stopped in today, I can tell you that she was always a strong supporter that folks do divorce each other, but they don't divorce their children. A divorce shouldn't result in being divorced from your children, just divorced from each other. So it's really not a partisan issue that we're here today about, nor a gender issue. And even in these very tough budgetary times, I think that these monetary, non-monetary things that you can pass that do good things for kids is really important. So to understand Representative Anderson's bill, you need a little context. Winning the physical custody label in a divorce case is no longer legally significant at all. There is no legal consequences that attach to you become the sole physical custodian. It is meaningless, and that's because when we changed the child support law to income shares, we took out looking at who was the custodial parent, and instead we simply said child support is based on the amount of time each parent has with their child. So being called physical custodian is meaningless and has no legal consequences attached to it to make it be a reason why you have to have that label used in a divorce decree. And when you change the law about moving children to a different state, that one parent wants to move to another state, you have to show that that's in the best interest of the child now, and it no longer is hinged on who has the physical custody label, who won the physical custody in a divorce case. So there are many judges these days who just don't use that label. Even though we don't have Diane Anderson's bill passed into law, there are judges who understand that you don't need to say that parent, that mom, that dad wins physical custody. It's a meaningless term. It doesn't mean anything in terms of the legal consequences that follow from that. So all that is required in a divorce decree for these judges that now say, no, I'm not going to award a physical custody label to somebody, all that's needed is what you see on lines 1.6 to 1.10 of the Delete Everything Amendment, and that is that a judge has to put down the schedule of time each parent spends with the child, and it could be 0%, or it could be 50-50, or it could be 25-75. All those things are being done now and will be done in the future in a parenting plan. Two, a designation of decision-making responsibilities regarding the child, and that can be you got joint legal custody, parent A has sole legal custody, or you can do a hybrid of that and say the parents are going to mutually discuss certain things like which school district and so on, and parent A gets to make the final decision because that's the school district where the child's going to be presumed to go. If they can't come to an agreement, then you go see a mediator. There's ways to do that, to word the decision-making that in a parenting plan that you can do in a sentence or two. Or you can do it in a longer version if the parents really want to work out all the ambiguities and possible things that could happen. And lastly, on 1.9, on 1.8, a method of dispute resolution. So you do have to write in, okay, folks, you know, here's how you're going to try and be business-like parents after your divorce and keep yourselves involved in raising your kid. And if you come to a disagreement, then you got to go see a mediator, or you go to a parenting consultant, or you go to a child psychologist, expert therapist type person who can help you figure out what's best for your kid. And as long as you write that in a divorce decree, you've got it all covered. You know what the schedule is, you know what the decision-making is, and you know how you're going to resolve disputes that come up in the future, and you don't have to have the physical custody label. That's what a parenting plan is. Parents that do lengthy parenting plans because they've been to Marilyn McKnight and they've worked out all the details and they want to have 15 pages can, but the change that Representative Anderson is bringing to this committee today is that judges will now do parenting orders. Orders is the important word. It's not that judges have to do a 15-20 page plan that thinks about every possible future event that could happen and how you're going to deal with it. All a judge has to do is an order that includes those three things that are on lines 1.6 to 1.8, the way that I described it. And that's what was going to happen with this bill. That's about it.
Representative Hillstrom has a question. Mr. Dawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dawkins, welcome back.
Yeah,
this went into place when I first came to the legislature. So I have just a few questions. What research do you have or information do you have that shows that the modifications that we've made over the last 10 years has actually reduced the number of court battles?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dawkins, Representative Hillstrom, that's such a good question because I think the financial impacts of this bill really need to be understood. The research is anecdotal. I haven't done a study. I don't think the court system has done a study. But if you talk to the judges that I talk to pretty often because I'm a child support magistrate or when I'm over in Ramsey County and the judges and referees that know me there, they'll tell you that this has reduced the number of court fights they have because they don't have to deal with the label any longer. This has increased the number of cases that get solved by a mediator so that they simply get presented in a document you ship to the court without a hearing that the judge signs off on. So there is less court time that gets spent because of the changes we made. There are more families that have amicably come to the solution for how to be businesslike about raising their children after the divorce. It's all anecdotal, but it's absolutely clear.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what about folks who don't have the financial capacity to hire these experts or do these alternative disputes? Who pays? And how does the court come to a conclusion when the people who are divorcing don't have the financial means?
Yeah, it's a problem, Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom. In Hennepin County, former family court judge, Chief Judge Bruce Peterson, has established a separate court now for folks that are not married, because more than 50% of Hennepin County's cases that come before the court to deal with custody are paternity cases, not married individuals. And what that court that Judge Peterson has set up does is send folks to the resources that are out there in the community. And most of these people don't have much money, but they go out there to figure out, how do I get a job so I can pay child support? How do I go to a parent education class so I know how to better get to be with my kids? And only after they've gone through those kinds of things do they come back in front of him and say, well, we've solved most of our problems, Your Honor, but we still got need you to help us on this one or that one. And that court is working well. So there are resources out there that are not necessarily as expensive as hiring a $300 an hour child psychologist or $150 an hour paid by each $300 altogether mediator. But in those cases where that is an issue, the folks just have to either do it themselves or submit it to the judge without lawyers' help there, and that happens a lot.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you saying that all counties have the same resources available that Hennepin County has available, or are we going to have great parenting plans in Hennepin County and not so great parenting plans in rural counties that don't have as many resources?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, it might be a dozen counties that I've practiced family law in since I left the legislature, not 20, but a dozen that I've been in. And they've been as far away as going up to Mora and going up to way up north. And everywhere that I've been, the parenting plan concept has taken hold enough so that folks figure it out and do it. How they do it all, I don't know. But it's happening everywhere.
Mr. Chair, just one quick statement.
Hillstrom.
Thank you.
And we're down to 10 minutes left. Just
certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Dawkins, I know that this has been something that you've worked on for a long time. I just want to make certain that if you're going to mandate something, that everybody has the ability to have a high quality, not just those that can voluntarily do it and afford it. So at the end of the day, when you're mandating something, I think you have to make sure that people have the resources to be successful.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dawkins.
Representative Hillstrom, this isn't a mandate in the way that you're thinking about it right now, okay? First, the parents can choose to do a parenting plan or not do one. And if they choose not to do one, then the court does a parenting order. And the only change is that the court's going to not say, you win physical custody. The court's simply going to do these three things. They're not going to get into the elaborate stuff that we're talking about. So I don't think that's a concern, and we don't have a lot of time for me to elaborate on that, because I'd like to hear more about it from you. But I think the question you're raising is so good and so important that I need everyone here to understand that that isn't what happens in this case. This doesn't go to a mandate where there's high-quality ones for some and low-quality ones for others. That doesn't happen here.
Representative Less, you have a question, but is it quick or?
He just answered, Mr. Chair, so I'll pass.
Oh, very good. Mr. Dawkins, I assume, will you be around for a little while?
I will.
Okay. And I believe you were the one that chief authored the parenting plan legislation originally, didn't you?
Along with Senator Cascaden, that's correct.
Correct. So thank you for your testimony. We'd like to make sure we hear from Mr. McNabb as well. And he's next on our agenda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Michael McNabb. I've been practicing law here in the state of Minnesota for over 30 years. After serving as a state prosecutor for a number of years in felony cases, I started my own law practice in Dakota County. And since 1980, practice in family court has been a regular part of my practice. I appeared before the Supreme Court task force that Representative Anderson discussed, and also I worked with Representative Dawkins on the parenting plan legislation. In essence, this bill builds upon that parenting plan legislation that was enacted in the year 2000. As you know from the previous remarks, the primary objective of that legislation was to shift the focus from parental rights to parental responsibilities. In a marriage dissolution proceeding, the parties are ending the husband-wife relationship, but they are not ending the parent-child relationship. The intent of parenting plan legislation is to encourage parties to spend their time and effort in discussing and developing a plan for raising their child rather than engaging in litigation over a custody label. The intent of the parenting plan legislation is to emphasize to the parents the need to plan how they will discharge their continuing responsibilities for raising their children. At the present time, the use of parenting plans is optional. This legislation would make parenting plans mandatory unless domestic abuse has occurred or unless the court finds that a parenting plan is not feasible. The legislation should enable us to realize the full potential of parenting plans. Those are really all the remarks that I have, but perhaps if I could respond to the one question that Representative Dawkins was just addressing about mandates. Right now in the law, if parents do not agree on a term, the rules of family court require parties to use alternative dispute resolution, whether it's going to be mediation, which is often the choice, or an early neutral evaluation, or some other form of alternative dispute resolution. We have that in the law right now. And is it a problem in terms of parties having the resources to pay for that? Yes, it is. But this bill here is not going to make any change as far as the realities of what we have right now in terms of the allocation of resources. We still, at the present time, require parties to attempt to use some form other than litigation to resolve disputes that come up in family law matters. This is not changed by this pending bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McNabb. Representative Lesh has a question. We're 5 minutes left, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I understood this, but maybe I don't understand this. My question is relates specifically to line 1.24 on the delete all amendment, giving a judge an out for determining that a parenting order is not feasible. Now, Mr. Dawkins just stated that as a judge, if the parents don't agree to a parenting plan, I can just write one, but I'm calling it a parenting order. I'm wondering if I'm in a situation where, say you got a husband who's a real jerk, and everyone knows he's a jerk, but there's no real domestic assault, even charges or convictions or what have you. But I got to pare this thing down so that he doesn't get his way with writing a parenting plan that twists the arm of the wife, can I, as a judge, just write a parenting order that gives her 70% of the time and allows for specific circumstances that he can see her? Or do I have to look for reasons and make detailed findings to do that?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dawkins.
Representative Lesh. Parent A has 70% of the time, parent B has 30% of the time. It'll be Mondays to Thursdays with A and every other Friday to Sunday with B. There will be sole legal custody to parent A, and that's the end of legal custody, not physical custody. Legal custody day, that takes care of that one. And if the parties have further disputes down the road about their schedule or anything else, then they go see a mediator. That short, that simple, nothing more. And the judge has written a parenting order. Or if a judge chooses, they can use this line 1.24 and simply go, I'm saying physical custody is with mom, and do it the old-fashioned way if they want. So it's all there in front of a judge for the options. But none of the options require a judge. The detailed findings about why an order is not feasible, I mean, what's a judge going to say? That I just, the detailed findings that these two don't get along at all. I've never seen anything that's so bad in my whole courtroom, and so therefore I'm not doing it, and I'm doing the traditional way, period.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I do have one more testifier, Marilyn McKnight. Was she on your list at all?
She isn't, but let's start. We're down to about 3 minutes left, so if she can, and if let's have Marilyn testify.
I'm Marilyn McKnight. I'm with Erickson Mediation Institute. I've been a mediator since 1977, mostly divorce and family. And my voice all of a sudden leaves me. have been doing parenting plans with divorcing people probably since 82. Started doing them that way. I worked on the parenting plan legislation. I'm an adjunct prof at William Mitchell teaching divorce mediation and an adjunct prof at Augsburg College in the Master of Arts and Leadership program. The making a parenting plan in every divorce where there are children or every circumstance with parents coming to the court to decide issues around children is a way of meeting interests of children. And parenting plans are not rubber stamps, they're not cookie cutters, but they are an opportunity for parents to think in terms of how they're going to operate in the future in raising children from two separate households and make that work so those children are least harmed by this divorce. It has worked in thousands, probably tens of thousands, more than that, cases in the state of Minnesota. State of Oregon was one of the first that had parenting plans, and they continue to refine theirs, and that's very, very good. I think the research is not out there because there's not funding for research. If there was, I think the research probably would show that parenting plans have decreased court time, certainly in divorce, particularly regarding custody trials and that sort of thing. But more important than that, I think that what the parenting plan does is allows parents to continue to have a parenting relationship and continue to raise their children so that each parent can have that relationship that is important for the children.
Ms. McKnight, we're probably down to about 1 minute left.
Okay. I think if you have questions, I probably would be happy to answer questions.
Okay. Members, any questions?
Mr. Chair.
And right now, members, it appears that we've only got one person that would be testifying in opposition, so we might have a little extra time after that. But Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me if any other state has this as a mandate in their law?
Oh, I don't know the number, but most states now have parenting plan legislation. Ohio, New York, Florida. I mean, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Billstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is that in all cases it's required, or is it similar to what you're proposing here, or is it just more voluntarily like we had since 2000?
I would have to look that up, and I'd be happy to look that up. Representative Hillstrom, Esquire.
Thank you.
And maybe to the author and Ms. McKnight, this will be going to the Judiciary Committee. Representative Hillstrom, are you on that committee?
I am, Mr. Chair.
You are. So our committee would be interested in it if you could pass that information to our committee administrator, but
yeah.
Representative Hillstrom will remember that question if we don't have it by the end, which we won't probably
okay.
have it today.
Yes,
so.
I will be happy to.
With that, we'd like to open it up to the opposing side, and then if there is some more time, we can ask questions. So thank you, Ms. McKnight. And we'll ask Ms. Hugdahl is asked to testify in opposition to this House file, and so we'll allow for her. And is there anybody else in the audience that is here to testify against it? If so, please send a note forward or let us know. We'll ask for this afterwards, but if we can plan on it, it's easier to try to work it in. So, Ms. Hugdahl, welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the record.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Services Advocacy Project. Actually, I wanted to come and put on the record really some concerns we had about the bill. I've spoken a couple of different times with Representative Anderson, who has really been great about talking with me about the bill, and I know this bill is going to make another stop. So we are in the process of trying to work with Representative Anderson to see if there is some language that we can all agree to on this particular bill. So I wanted to get out there what our concerns were so that people knew that. But just in way of context, that's... I wanted to lay that out there.
Ms. Hugdahl, do you want to lay out your areas of concern for the committee, or are they resolved at this point? And Representative Mahoney also has a question. So.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, that was my question, if she could lay out her concerns.
Okay. Ms. Hugdahl?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. Yes, briefly I can talk about really what it is. And I understand the goal that Representative Anderson is looking for people with agreements who have a full parenting plan, and maybe the traditional label is holding them up from having a full agreement. I certainly do understand that. Our concern lies more in the folks that either for the reasons that they don't agree or they don't have those resources to have a completed parenting plan, that they may not really fully understand the ramifications of having a presumptive label by law that may not reflect what their arrangement actually is. For example, for those folks who have a court that orders parenting time, that maybe it is 70-30 or 60-40, if they don't have a traditional label in their order, the bill would specify that they have joint physical custody. And I'm not sure that a lot of people going through the process on their own, if they're on their own, they haven't had the advice of counsel to understand what all of that means. And our experience has been for a lot of folks that they don't necessarily understand all of the other ramifications. So our concern with it is that for people where the court is issuing an order, because I think a fair number of the folks who do a parenting plan have either had advice of counsel somewhere along the way or some kind of mediation or some assistance, if they choose to use or not use traditional labels, I think that's a slightly different issue from those who don't agree, and we're not trying to foster an agreement anymore. It's the court issuing and the court deciding whether or not traditional labels would be used in the order, and if they choose not to, that a presumption applies that may not accurately reflect the parenting time that the parents actually have.
Representative Mahoney, any follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chair, here's something I don't quite understand with your concern. When you talk about participants in a divorce or a parenting action, so many of them, and I can't remember, and I actually had it spoken to me, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's over 50% are ex parte, you know, counseling of themselves. Mm-hmm. And they don't have access to an attorney. They don't have access to a mediator. Maybe they have access to a law library. I'm kind of wondering what's the difference.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think that's part of the folks we're talking about. When those folks, if they're trying to kind of do this the best they can on their own, if they come up with a parenting plan that has whatever time slot they choose, even if those folks... They may not understand that if they don't put a traditional label in, they're considered joint physical custodians, but in fact they are not. So the other piece, though, is where the court, they don't agree. Say they try, they don't have resources, and they go before the court and say, we don't agree, now, judge, you must issue an order that is contains the parenting plan elements. If the court chooses not to include the traditional label, then the presumptive joint physical custody label is their label, again, whether it's accurate or not. This is not something the parents have chosen for themselves.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mahoney. Use your microphone.
Mr. Chairman, it's Andy Dawkins again, if I could help.
Mr. Dawkins, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members and Representative Mahoney and Ms. Hugdahl, I really think the best way to understand Ms. Hugdahl's concern is divide the bill in half between lines 2.8 and 2.9. And her concern is in that second half, starting with line 2.9. And I don't know that that's a critical part of Representative Anderson's bill. So if, as we explore this going down the road with Ms. Hugdahl, and I've already told her I'm willing to, and she and I will be able to do that, if we can't bring some resolution of this to the next committee stop, the easiest way to solve it is, if we don't have agreement, is just simply separate this part out of the bill. And then I think she's fine with the rest of the bill.
Ms. Hugdahl, would that be accurate?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that it is. I think that would make us neutral on the bill if, in fact, we didn't have that piece with the court orders in particular using or not using, having a presumptive statutory label. Okay. So, yes.
Representative Hillstrom, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. One, has a fiscal note been requested on this? And then how does this parenting order and the changes affect child support enforcement? It's my understanding that DHS has previously testified against these kinds of changes, and so have you worked with them to address the concerns?
Ms. Anderson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Your committee chairman did request a fiscal note, and right now the fiscal analysts didn't think that there would be a fiscal impact. But a fiscal note has been requested, and that would be something we would deal with in the Judiciary Committee, since it's a fiscal policy committee. This is just a policy committee, and then so we'll have it before presenting to you in the Judiciary Committee.
And Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dockin.
Yes. And Representative Hillstrom, to your question. Being a child support magistrate, I see orders all the time that are written in all the various ways that we've talked about today, and all I care about is looking to the amount of parenting time that's in the court order. And I add it up, and if it's over 10%, and less than 45.1%, then you use the calculator one way. If it's under 10%, you use the calculator a different way. If it's between 45.1% and 50%, you use it a third way, and nothing will change on that. So the child support laws aren't going to be affected by what we do here. It's just, we might see more of one type of thing than another type of thing, but it won't be a new thing that we see as child support magistrates.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, too, I have the same recollection you did, that there were issues of interstate enforcement, perhaps, and having a label that might not reflect what the time was might impact interstate child support enforcement. So not being the Department of Human Services, I can't answer your specific question what their position is or isn't, but I do know that in the past that has been a conversation as part of this issue.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dawkins.
And Ms. Hugdahl and Representative Hillstrom and members, the interstate laws require that there be an obligor and an obligee in every quarter, not a physical custodian and a non-physical custodian parent. So you do have to, every order I write as a magistrate, has one of the parties as an obligor and one as an obligee. The obligor is the one that pays money to the other, and the other is the obligee. That we will need, and that won't change either. Now, if Department of Human Services comes forward and offers some else up, we'll have to think about it. But I think that was their concern in the past, and it's addressed because we don't change obligor and obligee.
Mr. Chairman, I was at the hearings when this was officially put in, when Andy Dawkins.
Representative Anderson, sorry.
And that was the issue way back then, and that's why that part of the language is in the bill today.
All right. Representative Hillstrom, anything? Representative Hilty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Probably this is a question for Mr. Dawkins. Mr. Dawkins, members, I think anyone who has served in the legislature has heard a number of complaints about child custody issues. I certainly have my share of them over the years. And I think that, from my experience at least, almost all of them are disputes not over what has been agreed to, but that whatever has been agreed to is not being enforced or not being abided by. I don't see anything here that will change that basic situation. Is it possible to do anything about actually enforcing agreements that are in place? Because I think, really, from my experience at least, that is the problem. People come to me and say, we agreed to this, and he or she is not living up to their end of the bargain, and nobody's doing anything about it.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Dawkins.
Representative Hilty, the first thing is that if the more people who amicably resolve their dispute ahead of time and put it down in writing in black and white on how the rules are going to be for the future, those folks are more inclined to be able to enforce it, follow it, live with it, go on with their lives, and never come back to court. It's the ones where the courts are having to do trials and make decisions and award one parent physical custody and the other parent relegated to secondary status, that's where that problem comes. So I think there'll be less of that problem, but it's not going to eliminate that problem. On the other hand, the courts themselves are figuring out ways to try to deal with the kind of cases you're talking about. One example that they use was actually a law that Representative Diane Anderson, when she was just Diane Anderson and I was the representative, came to me to do the parenting expediter statute. Parenting expediter statute works well for solving those kind of problems when they come up. You can go see an expediter. The expediter makes a decision. You can take the expediter's decision to the court as sort of an appeal of the expediter's decision, but you can get fast, non-expensive resolution of your case that way. But what I'm seeing more and more of is that the courts are using something called a parenting consultant. That's not in law. Parenting expediter is in statute. Parenting consultant is not. And the courts are saying when the folks are in a post-decree dispute, you know, I'm going to appoint a parenting consultant. You're going to go out there and you're going to talk to someone about figuring this kind of thing out. And they try to keep those solved in other ways. There's a lot more we can do. You know, if I had to write my favorite bill right today and bring it forward to the committee, it would be you don't have to go to court to get married. You shouldn't have to go to court to get divorced. We should save the judiciary a ton of money and just say that it's only when you've gone through a process of you went to a mediator, you went to a consultant, you went to parent education, and you haven't figured it all out, then you can isolate the one or two remaining issues to come to a court to get a ruling on. But we shouldn't have to come to court to get divorced in the first place.
Representative Mahoney, and then we have one more witness, and we're down about 10 minutes or less.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a question for Ms. Hugdahl. You said you had some concerns with Section 3, so maybe you can explain to me if in this parenting order it goes by default to JPC, but the judge has ordered a 10%, 90% split or a 40-60 split of parenting time. What is the problem? I mean, the judge has already ordered and signed this order saying 10%, 90%, or 30, more typically it's about 20-80. Could you please explain what your concerns are taking that whole thing off the table, that whole you're a primary parent, you're a secondary parent off the table?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I think there are a few issues, and one they all kind of really center on the fact of having an order that has a label that has kind of a common out in the world understanding of it that may not be reflective. And I think those cases that are not close to equal time are kind of the folks we're probably talking about, where the label really isn't reflective of what order they really have. One situation I know, getting back to the interstate issue too, is there are concerns, and we don't have a lot of these cases, but I know one of the concerns over the years too has been about interstate custody. If you had a parent who crossed state lines, would law enforcement in another state know what to do with an order that that by law said they had presumptive joint physical custody, even if in reality they didn't. That's one issue with it. But in our world, a lot of it has to do with that there are a lot of other agencies that our folks who are low income tend to have contact with, and when they look at things of who's in a household and eligibility and those kind of things, they tend to look at the judgment decree to see how many people are in there. And the custodial, the traditional label, when it's accurately applied, helps them kind of easily know where that is at.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and that was such a softball that I'll try to be kind about it. It seems to me that, you know, we should have the agencies accommodate the children versus the children and the divorcing parents accommodate the agencies, whether they're state agencies or nonprofits. Our kids need to not feel like they're owned by one versus not owned by the other. So, you know, I'll be kind to the agencies, profit, nonprofit, and government, but that's their problem, not our kids' problem.
With that, thank you. In case there is more questions, but there's we want one more testifier, Richard Amos. And is there anybody else that wants to testify for or against this bill? If you do, please get us notice through the page. They can bring us a note. Mr. Amos, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Richard Amos, and I'm a program director with St. Stephen's Housing Service, and I've been on advisor to a FHPAP for the past 15 years. I've also sit on the governor's advisory board for homelessness. I'm a father who was engaged to be married, and she got pregnant, and we had a son. In that, she went to another relationship, and I got married. When I got married, war was declared as far as visitation and establishing any kind of plan for me and my son to have a relationship. I took it to court about 10 times for non-visitation or visitation violations. The judge tried to figure out what was going on, and he said, okay, I'm done with it. I want you guys to exchange visitations at a police station of all places in the world. We did exchanges there a couple of times, and then she stopped coming, and the officer would give me these little blue tablets, blue slips that would say she didn't show. I have about 50 of them. And then the judge got transferred out of the district and our case dropped. I came here today when I read about this because it seemed like a way to create a plan where there wouldn't be so much adversarial in the relationship. My son, he doesn't really feel like he's bonded to me because anytime something comes up, he always looks towards his mom because she always has the last say. And I believe both parents should have the last say. As a kid, my father wasn't in the home, and my mom told me he died. And I used to always say, if my father was here, things would be different. We wouldn't be as poor. Somebody would play baseball with me. Somebody would take me places, you know, like other kids. And I felt real bad. So I wanted to be an extra good father to my son. And from this adversarial relationship we had, without the court involved and without a plan in place, it seemed like we were fighting all the time. And right till the day my son, I remember he said to me when he was about 8, Dad, anytime I say something good about you or that we did together, Mom gets mad at me. Or anytime I mention your name, she says she's having a bad day. And then he didn't say anything else about it. But now, whenever something comes up, a school event or if he wants to go camping or something like that, I said, well, how long are you going to be gone? Oh, I already asked my mom. She said I could go. He's 15 years old. I've never missed child support, even before he was born. I pay $780 a month, and I know you don't have to know that. And it affects my living, but I don't care about that. I want him to have a good life. But this plan, I think the plan, excuse me for saying this, but in the street, they say Minnesota is a woman's state because they always get their ways in court, you know? And I don't know if that's true or not, but it seems like dads should be involved some type of way, and they both
should have an equal say in what goes on with our child. We both made them. Nobody contributed anymore in that respect. So when does Minnesota get to a level where we look at it from other respects? Thank you.
Mr. Amos, thank you. One more person has given us a note. Holly Rillo, if you want to come forward.
Sorry, I didn't really realize I was going to speak today. But
well, welcome to the committee, and we're as harmless as we look. So.
My name is Holly Rillo. Thank you, Sheriff.
If you can identify yourself for the record, just so our tape picks up your name and if you represent a group or an organization.
My name is Holly Rillo, and I guess after listening to the gentleman and saying that Minnesota is a favorable state for women after going through the years and years of litigating in a courtroom and listening to a gentleman say that there is no fiscal impact on our children relating to this based on the child A, child B, the parenting plan. I guess I've been in the midst of the court process, been separated now for 7 years, divorced for five. There's a huge fiscal impact on our children. And I think what we need to begin to understand, it's not about the two parents. The children still deserve to have two parents, but they don't deserve to have one parent. I worked a number of overtime hours because of what was ordered in a courtroom for me to pay an ex-spouse for equity in a home that I'm now about to lose. The fiscal responsibility on both parties is not there. I paid my ex-husband $75,000+. I will never, ever, in all of my children's raising them of their years, I will never receive that amount back in child support. That doesn't bother me. The part that bothers me is that the equal parenting time that each parent should have with their children, while I was forced to work based on an order through a courtroom, I've had five attorneys, fiscal responsibility there, coming from a household where you have two parents earning equal income and dividing a household into two split families, each parent should still have equal fiscal responsibility. My bills have changed now since paying off my ex-husband. I'll never receive it. It's okay. I will be homeless shortly. I will still have to provide a roof for my two children because I am now currently unemployed because of my process. It's not about the parents. It's about our kids, and that's what we need to stay focused on because our children suffer in the long run. They will have years and years of anguish and resentment towards both parents based on what goes on in the courtroom and how things are divided. I don't know what else to say, but
Ms. Rillo, just so would you be in favor of this bill dealing with parenting plans, in favor or against? I wasn't real clear.
I really think that based on the laws and whatnot, the laws aren't protecting our children at all. It's about pitting one parent against the other one. And I don't necessarily agree or disagree with the bill. I'm just saying that I think you, as lawmakers, you have a tough decision and you have tough things to do. But I think in each of your laws, when there is one in place, there are several that negate that one law. And it's really, it's not about the kids in these cases. It's about the attorneys fighting back and forth for who's going to be the winner. Nobody wins when our kids lose. It's hard enough for our children when two parents separate and split up. When do we really, really stay focused on our children?
Thank you, Ms. Rillo. Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to testify for or against this bill? Members, any further questions for any of the witnesses or the author of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, can I just make a response for what you heard?
You can. Let's. I'll maybe incorporate that in your closing comments before we vote if there's no further questions. Representative Anderson, if you want to just give us some closing comments and in response to that, then we'll proceed to vote.
Yeah, I wish you could hear a little bit more from Marilyn McKnight today. I think really what's needed, and from the testimony of the people that showed up here today, is we really need a procedure for people to go through their divorces with less conflict. And I think that's what this bill is going to provide, that if we're going to change the focus. When people are going through a divorce, we're not going to have a focus of who's the better parent, let's fight over the kids, let's fight and fight and fight in court. We're going to use more of a mediated process. We're going to use a different process now. We're going to look at both parents as being fit parents, and how are we going to move forward to parent those children and try and get the fight over the children out of the divorce procedure. That's the ultimate goal of this parenting plan legislation. So I would like to get your support and ask for further moving of the bill.
With no further questions, thank you, Representative Lesh.
Thank you. I'd just like to note for the record that I agreed to pick up Girl Scout cookies tomorrow, and I got an email from my ex-wife saying, "You are awesome." So I just think that should be in the record of this committee after this bill. Thank you.
That's not what it says on your
book, then. With no further questions, members, the chair will renew Representative Wardlow's motion to pass House File 292 and refer it to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Thank you to all the witnesses and everybody that showed up with interest in this bill, and I trust that Ms. Hugdahl and the parties will work on some of those concerns before Judiciary. Yep. And Representative Hillstrom, there will be a fiscal note coming to the Judiciary Committee. Next, Representative Wardlow, House File 211. The chair will move House File 211 be passed. And we'll refer it to the Judiciary Committee, Representative Wardlow. I understand they might have a need for it. So, Chair has moved House File 211. There's also an author's amendment. The chair will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author wishes to have it. Any discussion on that? All those in favor, signify.
Mr. Chair, it's Lesh.
I'll represent Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask you about this before we passed it, because I don't think we have rules in the committee yet about receipt of amendments, but our committee staff did get a copy of this. I think it was 10 o'clock this morning, and we didn't have a huge amount of time to review it. So, and I don't think we'd passed the rules yet. Maybe we had if I missed it. But when I talked to you, you had stated that the intention was to have a 24-hour amendment rule, but it could be waivable by the chair at your discretion. So I guess I was wondering, we did get blindsided a little bit by this when we first received it. What is going to be the practice?
Representative Lesh, I might be able to answer your questions. Actually, I modified 24 down to 3 hours in the rules that we did present to the committee. And we did forward it on to your staff as soon as we had gotten it, or it was within a little margin of error. But the 24-hour rule is a 3-hour prior to the hearing, which is what we settled on.
Understood, Mr. Chair. Noting just that sometimes that gives some of my members cause to ask more of the questions if it's not understood, but I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Lesh, the intent would be to get the bill in the shape the author has agreed to make some changes, and so when they present it, it's in the way the bill looks as they would like to have it amended. So if that's all right, we'll put it in.
And absolutely, Mr. Chair, I understand that. I understand that as a chair, I wanted to get bills in the shape that the authors wanted. It's just that when people were looking at a different version up really close to the committee, that caused some confusion despite the trying to make sure that things flow smoothly. So thank you for your clarification, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Otherwise, discussion? The chair will move the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the way the shape the author would desire to have it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Wardlow, we're also going to try to allow both sides to have 25 minutes. You need to allow for some questions from the committee, and we'll push other burning questions off to the end if we get to 25 minutes, and then we'll open it up for the anybody opposed to your bill or with other comments, and then we'll follow the same type of procedure. So with that, please present your bill, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 211 is a bill that is about jobs and economic development. It may be about tort reform, and it may be about class action lawsuits in particular, but it fundamentally comes down to jobs and free enterprise innovation. And to set the context for understanding this bill, I'd just like to quote Alexis de Tocqueville, one of my favorite authors from Democracy in America, who wrote in 1835, as he commented on what he saw living and traveling around the United States, that he said, "Scarcely any question arises in the United States which does not become, sooner or later, a judicial debate." So I think Mr. Tocqueville is probably one of the first persons to recognize the American propensity, perhaps, to litigate, to bring disputes to court. But he wasn't always correct, because he also wrote that lawyers, quote, have little to gain from innovation, unquote. And as attorney, I know that that is not the case. I've seen it firsthand. And now, almost 200 years later, we have a situation where these two things, these two ideas from Mr. Tocqueville about the culture of litigiousness and lawyer innovation have combined to create a situation where jobs and economic development in Minnesota are threatened. They're threatened because zealous attorneys who are rightly zealous on behalf of their clients, especially on the plaintiff's side, are very, very innovative. And they are entrepreneurial even. And that, combined with a general tendency towards the litigious, creates a situation where defendants, oftentimes job creators, have to pay significant costs to deal with our tort system and its rules, which are sometimes arcane, but nonetheless, we can correct them, we can fix them, and we can limit the abuses, and that's what House File 211 does, at least in one respect. With regard to a particular innovation of trial attorneys over time, and that is the class action lawsuit. So the bill, as amended, basically does three things. First of all, under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, the Prevention of Consumer Fraud Act, and the False Statement in Advertisement Act, for claims brought, individual or class action claims brought under those acts, it requires not just a causation, not just a nexus between the misrepresentation or statement or omission and the damages allegedly suffered by the plaintiff, but it requires that each plaintiff show detrimental reliance upon the alleged misrepresentation, statement, or omission. Secondly, it requires that each plaintiff actually have out-of-pocket losses, some kind of damage, some kind of real damage, in order to recover. That's a pretty simple requirement. It seems like common sense, but oftentimes, through the innovation of attorneys, common sense is thrown out the window. So this would replace some common sense. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, with regard to class actions, the bill provides for interlocutory appeals as a matter of right. What that means is as soon as a class is certified by the court, and the class action may therefore go forward, the defendant may appeal directly to the Court of Appeals and get an answer within a relatively expeditious time frame as to whether that decision to certify a class was appropriate. Right now, as the law stands, that right is discretionary, and the defendant does not have as a matter of right that route to appeal. And the class certification decision, oftentimes, these lawsuits rise or fall on that certification at the outset. Interlocutory appeals, the history of interlocutory appeals shows that exceptions to the finality rule are generally made when it would be prejudicial to one party to make them to wait until the end of a process in order to appeal an order that has some finality to it. And that's what we have here. Businesses often have to pay, they choose to pay to settle rather than face unknown risks of jury trial and perhaps crippling financial losses. Now, 10 other states in the United States, of course, have adopted reforms like this, including Texas and Ohio, Louisiana, Missouri, Kansas, among others, Florida. So 10 other states are doing this. Minnesota must not be left behind and become a haven for lawsuits. Minnesota should not become, we shouldn't do anything that would worsen Minnesota's business climate. This protects Minnesota's business climate and makes it a place where private innovation and entrepreneurship, as apart from that of attorneys, can thrive and create jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wardlow. If you want to move right into your testifiers.
I'll turn it right over to Bob Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, if welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson. I'm with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm here testifying today on behalf of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. You should have a piece of paper in your packet from our organization that lists the members. It's comprised of 45 trade associations and chambers of commerce and then 93 individual businesses. Collectively, it represents 58,578 employers in the state of Minnesota. We urge passage of House File 211. We think that an efficient tort liability system in this state is an important ingredient for a thriving free enterprise economy. An inefficient system, an unfair and inequitable one, has a negative impact, we believe, on the production of goods and services. Our goal is to have a more balanced, predictable, and affordable civil justice system in the state. As Representative Wardlow has indicated, and then we did have an opportunity a couple of weeks back here before this committee, Mike Hickey and myself. Mike is a board member. Another board member is Tom Hesse of the Minnesota Chamber, and the other board member of the organization is John Hauslotten of the Minnesota Trucking Association. The key thing is this, that in our opinion, that civil justice reform, tort reforms, whichever word you want to use, directly relate to a state's jobs and economic development climate. We believe the evidence and proof is there. I referenced it at that time, and I'll just reference it again. A study from Texas that was done by the Perryman Group, it's called Texas Turnaround, the Impact of Tort Reform on Business Activity in the Lone Star State. And a very specific quantification over an eight-year period with four tort reforms that the Texas legislature enacted, and a measurement of the increase in jobs and a measurement in the increase of spending in that state's economy as a result of the tort reforms. Again, the key point is this. There may be a debate or there'll be a challenge that tort reform changes to the civil justice system are not relevant to the state's economy. They are relevant to state economies. The Texas study is a specific example. I also referenced a study called the Pacific Research Institute, the U.S. Tort Liability Index, a 2010 report that measures and quantifies and compares the 50 states on their tort inputs. They're described in the tort outputs. And by that study and given the time, we can't go into it here, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I urge you to take a look at it. It looks at the current state of state laws, ranks them, with one being the best state statutes from the perspective of business groups, 50 being in the worst condition or not good state statutes, and Minnesota ranks 47th in that ranking of the 50 states, so we have a ways to go in terms of our laws. Lastly, Mr. Chairman and committee members, this is an active issue that's being given attention around the country. Wisconsin a week ago had a special session they passed, and it was a special session for tort reform. They passed some comprehensive reforms to deal with the bottom line costs of their nursing homes and other industries. North Dakota had a hearing last week at their Senate Judiciary Committee, and we'll track that bill that deals with their six-year tort statute of limitations. It's an issue that's not before the committee today, but we'll be introducing a bill So, Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the 58,578 employers who are part of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, we support House File 211 as presented and urge the committee to adopt it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Is there a Mr. O'Neill as well?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for the opportunity.
Can I identify yourself for the record? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Jim O'Neill, and I am the head of the general litigation group at Fagre & Benson. My group is about 50 lawyers. We, our biggest practice area in my group is the defense of class action and mass tort lawsuits, typically involving product liability or consumer fraud. So I've been doing that in Minnesota and around the country. I've been in practice about 32 years. Actually, listening to Representative Wardlow, I kind of like that, Minnesota being a haven for lawsuits. Maybe I should go sit with Sharon Van Dyke back there. But setting aside my own personal interests, which would be against this bill, I do support this bill. I hadn't heard of it till a few days ago. But when it was run by me, I thought that it was a way to address three things that I find really unjust about the way that consumer fraud class actions take place. One of those is the fact that it remains difficult to get an interlocutory appeal of the class action decision, despite the fact that there's a recognized procedure to seek an interlocutory appeal, to ask the Court of Appeals if they will agree to take a case, and sometimes they do, but most often they do not. I also think that the case law imposed kind of an unrealistic standard or burden on defendants who want to get appellate review of a class certification decision before spending years and potentially hundreds of thousands or billions of dollars getting ready for trial. And that is that one of the prongs of the potential for appellate review is that the size of the case is so large that you really can't try it because of the what's called interorum effect of the fear that your whole company, even a big company, could go out of business if you lose this case and a jury is always a crap. Well, you can't say that. I mean, you may feel that way, but when you go to court and you don't know if they're going to take your appeal and you don't know what's going to happen with the jury, you really can't go on record and argue this case is so big and so frightening we're going to settle it. So it's very difficult, really, to get interlocutory review of class certification decisions. The reality is the vast majority of class actions never get tried, and if they are certified, there is a great pressure to settle these things because of the size of the money, theoretically and potentially, at issue. The second injustice that I believe exists is the lack of a requirement of detrimental reliance. That, in some respects, may be the most controversial issue. Let me put that to third and just cover the second one, which is the out-of-pocket loss requirement. As I read this bill, and as I say, I didn't have any knowledge of it till a few days ago, it doesn't say the only thing that you can recover is out-of-pocket loss, but it says you have to have had some out-of-pocket loss in order to make any recovery at all. I think this is a step toward ending what we call the no-injury class. I am defending right now two very large class actions, very troubling damages potentially in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, in which there is a product, mass-produced product, many, many of them out there, very low failure rate, but a failure rate, because pretty much all products have failure rates, and that's what warranty law is for. The plaintiffs say, well, my expert, this engineer I'm paying to testify by the hour, says that all your products are going to fail. They're all terrible, and this low rate of failure is so bad that they're all going to fail. And therefore, they expand the potential exposure from just the number that have failed to everything you sold. And you may think, oh, that's crazy. Well, I thought it was crazy, but in both the cases I'm dealing with, the court certified a class action. We need to be able to get appellate review of those things, and with the out-of-pocket loss, we also need to make sure that people who haven't suffered any injury as a result of the alleged misconduct, any injury, are not able to make a recovery and pose an exposure that threatens the company. Lastly, with respect to detrimental reliance, this is a long, complex story. Fraud cases very rarely, common law fraud, very rarely get certified because the law is quite clear that detrimental reliance is an individual question. Now, the current consumer fraud laws are based upon statutes written back in the 60s for the FTC and for government agencies, and private causes of action were sort of thrown in there at the end. And when the statutes were written, people didn't want reliance to be required because they wanted the Attorney General to be able to say, this is a misleading statement, I can shut you down even if I don't have anybody testify, they saw it and relied upon it. But the plaintiff's bar has evolved that into saying, well, I can recover damages for these people for your misleading ad, even though they never saw the ad, and I don't have to show that they saw the ad. And it seems to me that because of this historical accident that these things came out of the FTC and Attorney General laws, that makes no sense at all. Since when do we start giving people money for private causes of action when they didn't even see the offending ad and therefore cannot have relied on it and cannot have been harmed by it? There's a long story about causation and detrimental reliance in the group health case. I don't think I have time to get into all this, but the short answer is that detrimental reliance ought to be required if somebody's going to make a claim for money damages against a company based on a misleading statement or advertisement. So those are the three things that I think rectify current injustices in the way that consumer fraud class actions occur. And I'll be happy to address questions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Neill. Representative Hortman has a question.
Thank you. I have a question.
We're about 10 minutes left on this site.
Mr. O'Neill, what incentive is there for a company not to make misleading statements if the only thing they have to worry about is the Attorney General seeing it and stopping them? If there's no chance that a private party, a private group of litigants can get money damages, wouldn't the company just say, let's take a flyer on this one and see if we get caught?
It's not just the Attorney General. It's a whole panoply of regulators, the FDA, the FTC, numerous government regulators. That's point one. Point two is this is based on some sort of strange idea about how companies make money. Companies make money by appealing to consumers and customers and developing good products with good instructions. And if those things are faulty and fail and do not make money, then it is not in the company's interest. What these class actions are typically about is a technical statement that they catch you in some error that you made.
Follow up.
Representative Portman, follow up.
Well, I understand that the vast majority of businesses are in the interest of providing good customer service, and that's how they stay in business, but I think that these particular laws were drafted for the people who want to make money by ripping people off. I mean, I'm sure that everybody in this committee and you yourself have probably received a solicitation in the mail from a company that says things that just cannot be true. And our mechanism to pull in senior citizens or less sophisticated consumers and get money, you know, the fake check thing. And so if there's no incentive for them to, if there's no reason for them to fear a significant monetary loss, they're playing basically the audit lottery. You know, will we get caught by the AG or the FTC? I don't think that's enough disincentive for the companies that are shysters and just want to rip people off.
Well,
Mr. O'Neill.
First of all, I should have mentioned the attorney or the consumer fraud statute provides for attorney fees so that people on an individual basis can bring claims, be represented, and there's an incentive to the attorneys to bring those because they get their hourly wage or attorney fee. What we are seeing is that these statutes, which were created for the shyster company, are in fact being used by lawyers to generate attorney fee bills in class actions in the millions of dollars when what people get for the settlement is nothing. One of my partners got a thing in the mail saying she bought some golf equipment from a golf store and she was supposed to get a free set of balls and she didn't get it, she got gloves instead. So there was a class action with several million dollars in attorney fees and they recovered and she got golf balls. She didn't even get her golf gloves, she didn't even get her golf balls this time. This stuff is going on. There are class actions with millions of dollars and people getting virtually nothing out of it other than the lawyers.
Representative Mahoney and then Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as not the regional reason for my question, but just so you know, that's exactly the same kind of setup they have for labor law. And if you, as a working stiff, I got to tell you, if I get into a dispute with an employer over labor law, I will not get an attorney because all I can recover is my lost wages. And no lawyer, unless I'm willing to spend tens and tens of thousands of dollars, is going to take that case. So essentially what you're saying is that, you know, we're not going to have fraudulent cases brought to court. My real question, though, is for Mr. Johnson. So can you tell me you said that we rank 49th in lawsuits on product liability laws and lawsuits on this particular issue, tort reform. Can you tell me what our insurance rates, because no good company would bother to open up its doors without decent insurance, and I know you, knowing insurance as well as you do, should have that off the top of your head, what the rates are comparable in Minnesota for tort reform, tort insurance as opposed to Texas or Florida? And if this bill passes, can you give us some idea of what the insurance industry will be lowering those particular costs for our companies in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Johnson,
a couple of questions in there. I don't have at hand, but I will follow up and get you specific data. I think that you're looking at general liability premiums, which is the one that businesses buy. So I can get you comparative data just to show what's paid in Minnesota. I can get you for all the states.
Well, Mr. Chair, could you get me one from a non-insurance paid for study, though?
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I can get you is the data that insurers file, that it's confirmed or collected by the regulators. So if that's an adequate basis, we insurers file with state Commerce and Insurance Department's data, so they're familiar. You could find that out from Commissioner Rothman in Minnesota in terms of aggregate premiums that are paid in this state. So we have data that we can get to you that shows on a comparative, on a state-by-state basis, the information that you asked. I don't have it here today, but that's available. So we can get that. I think the question of your second question is impact if the legislature is to pass some bills like this, and we're working on a package of bills. This is one. There are three other bills that the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform will be advancing, and we're actually talking with some of the statistical organizations and the economic quantification studies that I mentioned for Texas that are done in other states. I don't have that here today, but we will incorporate that and have that as part of the debate and discussion as additional bills come forward. So we're working on that. I don't have a number here today. It's not going to lend itself to a a simple calculation because there are a number of factors that go into it. But we expect that that's a question. It'll be part of the discussion. The group that I mentioned, the Pacific Research Institute, has done state-specific studies for New York, which I can get you a copy of that one, that the legislature asked the same question. If tort reforms are passed, what should we in the state expect to happen in the state economy in terms of jobs and, you know, revenue spending? So there's one that's been done for the state of New York. We've talked to the organization that did that, and one for the state of Tennessee. I think it's in progress. So the point is this: there's specific concrete information that's been assembled that answers the question on what would happen, what would you expect to happen in a state economy if specific reforms are enacted, such as contained in House File 211. I don't have it here today, but we're working on it. And as we work on it and develop it, we'll share it with you. But the point is this: from the perspective of the members of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, there is no question that civil justice system in a state directly impacts the economy, it impacts the businesses, and reforms in the civil justice system have a quantifiable and a bottom line impact on the businesses operating in that state. We don't have any question about that. We think the evidence is concrete and clear that shows that. And so from our perspective, you know, House File 211 represents a change that deals with some inefficiencies, some unfairness, some inequities, and we should pass it in the law in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
I might just add, if I may, an answer to that question, that since we are talking about consumer protection claims, much of that is not going to be insured. Some of it is, and the potential for getting your defense costs paid is pretty good. But ultimately, for example, in these no-injury claims, if there is no actual damage to a product, it may well be that there's no insurance coverage. So just about every case I deal with in this area, there's also a lawsuit about insurance coverage, and often there's a big uninsured exposure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney, and then I'll be very, very brief.
Representative Wardle, you brought forth the idea of economic development. I've been promoting economic development for 10 years. All I've ever heard is anecdotal. So, and I'm surprised that Mr. Johnson did not bring those figures, knowing the nature of this committee. We're a very inquisitive committee. So I'll be interested to see if your studies, Mr. Johnson, line up with the ones that I, over the last 10 years, have been looking at, and see very little correlation to those rates and or to the job market.
Members, I'd like to get to the 25 minutes for the proponents is up, and I would like to get to starting on the opponents, and there's a couple witnesses that are here that it doesn't work out to come back next week, as it will turn out, or whenever it comes back up. So if I understand Representative Lesh and Simons, it's okay if we move to the witnesses and we'll forestall the questions at this point. Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Johnson, thank you. And first we'll call Mr. Prentice Cox from the U of M. And second, Jeff Half, if you want to be on deck or come up to speed up the time. And Mr. Cox, welcome to our committee. If you want to identify yourself for the record, we'll start on 25 minutes for the opponents, and if you can keep it fairly brief, but I don't want to rush you beyond what you want to present to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to keep it brief. To avoid unintended consequences,
Mr. If you could just identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Prentice Cox. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota Law School, and was an assistant attorney general for 14 years and manager of the Consumer Enforcement Division during that time as well.
Very good. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To avoid unintended consequences with this bill, it is really essential that you understand the history of the development of the statutory fraud laws that are at issue. The laws were passed, as Mr. O'Neill said, in the 1960s. But actually, Mr. O'Neill got it wrong. The private right of action did not come in at the same time as the Consumer Fraud Act or 8.31. It came in as an amendment in 1973, hence its designation 3A. And that put a private right of action in the law. The law was fairly uneventful until 2000, when the case of Levy-Nystrom was passed. And the Levy-Nystrom case took a funny turn and engrafted a public benefit test onto the private right of action for statutory fraud laws. The result in a study that I did in 2006, actually my research assistant was your counsel, he did a great job, was that the cases by individuals, including farmers, were completely eliminated. No individual survived a motion to dismiss or summary judgment in those first 6 years. Since that time, it's essentially unchanged. There's been a couple of people who've randomly survived. But whenever the defense of public benefit is brought up, individuals have had their cases dismissed. As a result, the only ranking I'm aware of, when we're talking about rankings of states, this isn't about general tort reform. That usually involves matters of health insurance and these sorts of things. The only ranking I'm aware of on consumer fraud acts and statutory fraud laws put Minnesota near the bottom in protecting consumers as a result of this Levy-Nystrom decision that wiped out, for all practical purposes, the rights of individuals and farmers, and in some cases small businesses, to bring actions under the law. The next development was a year later in the group health case, which Mr. O'Neill referred to as well, and that was a case about whether class actions against a tobacco manufacturer could survive. The issue was whether common law justifiable reliance, detrimental reliance, had to be pled and proved, and the court in a unanimous decision held that the standard for statutory fraud in a private right of action was not common law detrimental reliance or justifiable reliance. Had detrimental reliance been put in, as this bill suggests, I think it's fairly clear that the suit against the tobacco manufacturer would not have survived. The bill makes three or four, depending on how you look at it, we'll say four changes. Section 2 makes two changes. The first change in Section 2 is to add this back, this requirement of detrimental reliance. Given the history of how the statutory fraud law has developed in Minnesota, adding detrimental reliance in is almost tantamount to eliminating a private right of action. Individuals no longer have a right to sue, essentially. If you do this, class actions will be severely curtailed, and it will be almost impossible to bring a class action under the statutory fraud laws, and thus leave our private right of action as essentially written out of the law. An example of that would have been the Peterson v. Bassett case, and again, I hate to keep referring to Jim, but I think you were the defense counsel on that, so if I say something wrong, you can beat me on the head. In the Peterson v. Bassett case, for instance, farmers, a group of farmers, were suing the chemical company because they were sold a chemical as a premium and a basic chemical, and the ones that bought the premium chemical were actually buying the exact same thing to spray on their crops as the basic. They were just being charged more. So there was a class action brought in Minnesota, and that class action survived summary judgment. It went up and down several times in our appellate courts, and eventually the farmers did recover. Had this bill been in existence, there would have been no remedy for those farmers. The second change in Section 2 is the introduction of the out-of-pocket loss. This would tie damages under statutory fraud to damages, not all forms of relief, but damages and statutory fraud to the common law fraud standard, which is out-of-pocket loss. Minnesota actually subscribes to the minority rule among states, requiring out-of-pocket loss calculations for damages in cases of common law fraud. But here's the distinction. In common law fraud cases, the courts often depart from that rule. They find exceptional circumstances, and the rule is riddled with exceptions because the courts look at the individual facts of the case and say, well, there was real harm done here, but it doesn't really meet our out-of-pocket test. And so they make an exception to the out-of-pocket rule. This law would bind the courts with a rigid rule and make damage calculations under the statutory fraud statutes actually worse than the damage calculations under common law fraud, and eliminate the ability of the courts to deviate from that standard where there's real harm. And let me give you an example of that. There were class actions certified with the subprime mortgage companies, which I'm very familiar with that litigation because I brought it all on your behalf, I hope you see it that way, with the state of Minnesota. There were also class actions certified, for instance, against AmeriQuest Mortgage Corporation, one of the absolutely worst actors. And there was a suggestion before that it's a strange description of how companies operate to suggest they do anything but want to, you know, service customers well, et cetera. Well, let me tell you, there was a lot of strange companies then over the last 10 years, over the last 15 years, selling mortgages until the collapse. And this was one of them. How you had an out-of-pocket damage rule, cases against subprime mortgages would not have gone forward because the kind, in most cases, because the kind of harm, which was obvious, people were sold mortgages they shouldn't have had, and they eventually many of them lost their homes, but trying to quantify that under a rigid out-of-pocket damage rule would have been very difficult, and therefore those cases would not have gone forward. The other two changes are in Section 3, and to briefly mention those, I'll just lump them together. Of course, there's the absolute right instead of the discretion to bring the appeal, the interlocutory appeal on class certification, just in this narrow set of cases, and also the stay of discovery while the interlocutory appeal is pending. These changes would create discrepancies with the federal rule. I also teach civil procedure, by the way, to give you some credentials for this at the law school. But these changes would make a discrepancy with the federal law. So this would mean that Minnesota has a different standard than the federal courts use for appeals under Rule 23. It would also make Minnesota discrepant with the vast majority of states, particularly outside the South, the vast majority of states' rules on appeals, and it would bind the court to make rigid rules and eliminate their discretion, or in the case of the discovery, flip the requirements for when discovery can go forward and force further motions in the court in order to litigate that issue. Last but not least, I will not go through all the elements of proof. I think sometimes people have the sense that these cases are easy or something. In fact, in the study we did in 2006, looking back over the last 10 years, by 3-1, these cases were dismissed under statutory fraud laws. By 3-1, on motions as a matter of law. It's hard to win these cases as a plaintiff. One question one might ask is there examples? Are there examples of Minnesota courts, abusing these statutes so that plaintiffs that people think common sense shouldn't win should win? And I frankly can't think of one where Minnesota courts have reached out and certified class actions or awarded damages in situations where it was inappropriate. You have to prove it's in connection with the sale of merchandise, for instance, under the Common Consumer Fraud Act. There's proper party standards. You have to show negligence. It's not a strict liability statute. You also then, of course, have to prove it was deceptive or a misleading statement. You have to show the public benefit, thus eliminating all the individuals. And last but not least, there is a requirement of injury. It was also said that in a situation without the out-of-pocket rule, any injury will, you can have cases with no injury at all. In fact, you not only have to show injury in order to bring a case under the statutory fraud laws, you have to show that the injury was caused by, there was a causal nexus to the deceptive practice. So for all these reasons, I hope you will consider that this law may have unintended consequences. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. I think we'd like to get to Mr. Hoff, and we're getting to the end of the committee hour. And so if we could get through Mr. Hoff, committee members, then I think we'll pick this up at our next, when it gets rescheduled or continued.
All right.
If you can identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Half, one half of something. I'm an attorney at the law firm of Dady & Gardner, PA. I've been practicing since 1989. My primary practice is representing franchisees, dealers, and distributors in Minnesota and nationwide. I am glad to see that the amendment was made that took out the provision about natural persons only being able to sue under this statute because franchisees, dealers, and distributors who are businesses and who do a lot of economic development for the state of Minnesota generally do business through S-Corps and C-Corps. So in the future, when you draft litigation, if you could keep in mind that there are a lot of good small businessmen out there who are not natural persons, that would be great. I won't repeat everything that's just been said. However, I have a few things I think the committee needs to hear. First of all, if you're going to have a statute that states that someone may only sue upon detrimental reliance, okay, the courts are going to ask, does that have to be reasonable reliance? I don't know, but it's not set forth here in this statute, okay? There's generally actual reliance, reasonable reliance, detrimental reliance. Detrimental reliance doesn't give the court any idea as to whether or not it has to be reasonable. Okay, so if you're going to draft a statute, you have to draft a statute that courts can interpret. I would say that detrimental reliance doesn't tell you anything at all. I find it interesting that a lot of the cases that involve this statute are cases brought by insurance companies. The Blue Cross and Blue Shield case against the cigarette companies, brought by insurance companies. A recent case, the Kinetic Company versus Medtronic Inc., 672 F. Sup. 2nd, 933, brought by a self-insured employer seeking to recover insurance costs. So I'm a little surprised that the insurance company is here telling people that we have to have this statute amended because there won't be any claims brought by these insurance companies to recover their costs. Another part of Section 8.31, Section 2. No award of damages may be made in an action covered by this subdivision without proof that the person or persons seeking damages suffered an out-of-pocket loss. Again, does not define what an out-of-pocket loss is. If someone puts me, if I am a franchisee owning a Taco Bell and the nearby Taco John's engages in consumer fraud to the general public, thereby putting me completely out of business, have I suffered any out-of-pocket losses? Generally not. Most courts say that an out-of-pocket loss is money you actually take out of your pocket. If you have lost profits, even lost profits that put you out of business, that is not out-of-pocket losses. So if my competitor just wants to put me out of business under this statute, I have no claim. In addition, if my competitor wants to engage in false advertising to the public that puts me out of business, I undoubtedly don't believe that false advertising. If I'm a businessman, I don't believe my competitor's false advertising, so I also don't have any detrimental reliance under the statute. So this statute makes it impossible for a competing business to sue another competing business due to these false statements, even admittedly false statements. And if they're forced out of business, I would argue in court, they are not suffering out-of-pocket losses. Another issue, as the gentleman from Fager and Benson said, is I don't know if the statute says I'm limited to my out-of-pocket damages or not. If I have $1 of out-of-pocket damages, can I then sue for millions and millions of dollars of pain and suffering damages? I don't know. It's not clear from this statute that you've drafted. If you're going to draft a statute, you have to draft a statute that actually explains to people what you mean. I can imagine somebody is going to go into court and say, well, it says you're limited to your out-of-pocket damages. If I'm the plaintiff's attorney, I'm going to say, no, all I need to show is that I have $1 of out-of-pocket damages, and then I can recover every other damage. The class action case in 2005, George Bush signed into law what he called the Class Action Fairness Act. Under an act that was signed by President Bush, about as pro-tort reform as any person in the world, the 2005 Class Action Fairness Act says that you can't appeal from a class action certification unless you can prove extraordinary circumstances. So we have a federal law that's passed by a Republican Congress and a Republican president, and what I'm hearing today is that somebody's coming here saying, well, that's not fair at all. Minnesota needs a worse rule. And what will Minnesota's rule be? The only class actions that stay in the state of Minnesota after the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005 are class actions that deal primarily with Minnesota residents being injured. You have to have two-thirds of the people that are being injured have to be Minnesota residents, and then you have a chance of keeping it in Minnesota court. If you're in federal court, this law that you've submitted is worthless. Judge Rosenbaum's not going to enforce it, or he retired. Judge Montgomery's not going to enforce it. This law only applies to Minnesota state court class actions. And so what you're saying here by passing this law is that Minnesotans who are injured and have a big class deserve far less protection than non-Minnesotans who can go into federal court. So this law, as you've drafted it, is just a disaster. And even if I was a proponent of this law, I wouldn't want it passed. One final thing. There is another provision in here that says, denying a motion to decertify a class is appealable as a matter of right. Here's what that means. If you certify the class originally, and then I take three depositions, and I want to make another motion again to decertify the class, I can do that. And then I can try again, and again, and again, and again. There's just multiple bites at the apple. In any event, I think I've made my position on this clear, so if you have any questions.
Mr. Half, thank you for your testimony. We are at the end of the committee time. We went over about 5, 6, 7 minutes. I understand when it comes back up again, it may not work for you to come back. Is that so hard to say at this point?
If you just tell me when, I might be in trial, but otherwise I can come.
Okay. So, members, we'll lay this bill or continue this bill on a future agenda. And so with that, thank you for your testimony, and the meeting is now adjourned.